Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute. Thank you very much for coming out this evening. My name is Meriden Varal. I'm the East Asia Program Director here at the Lowy Institute. A year ago, almost to the day, we were here at 1 Bligh Street to dissect the results of the US presidential election. A bit of a surprise to some of us and a shock to some of us. I'm not looking at anyone in particular. President Donald Trump is in China, where he will become the first U.S. president to dine in the Forbidden City as part of China's State Visit Plus. He's already visited Japan and Korea and employed his unique style of diplomacy in those lucky countries. Trump will be in China until tomorrow when he travels to Vietnam for the APEC summit and a series of bilateral engagements. From Vietnam, he'll travel to Manila for the U.S. ASEAN and newly added to his itinerary East Asia summit, and will meet the Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. So Trump in Asia is obviously a hot topic at the moment, and we have with us this evening a panel of eminent experts on the topic. We have a panel broad enough to cover all of the countries and also deep enough to add some nuance and some real depth of understanding to the conventional wisdom that's going around at the moment. To start with, let me introduce my colleague Aaron Connolly. He's a research fellow here at the Lowy Institute in the East Asia program. He specializes in Southeast Asia and the US role in the region, so well placed to talk about this. Prior to joining us, he worked closely with the former US National Security Advisor, the late Sandy Berger, as a director at Albright Stonebridge Group, a consultancy in Washington. He's the author of a new Lowy paper, Institute Analysis, released last week on President Trump's East Asia policy. We also have with us tonight Dr. Huong Le Thu, who is a political scientist and Vietnam specialist, currently based at the Australian National University in Canberra. Huong received her PhD in international relations with a focus on Asia-Pacific studies from the National Chengshe University in Taiwan. She speaks five languages and has published in four of them, so quite impressive. Her latest publication on the US-Vietnam relationship, fortunately, is in English, so you'll be able to enjoy that one. We also have my colleague, Dr. Ewan Graham, who is the International Security Program Director here at the Lowy Institute. He received his PhD in 2003 before going to the Foreign Office and later served as the British Chargé d'Affaires in Pyongyang. In addition to his North Korea experience, he also has a long history working on Japan, maritime security, and Southeast Asia. So we're very well placed to have a jolly good discussion about these issues tonight. So what we're going to do to start with is we're going to ask our eminent panelists to give us some headline points on what we've seen so far and what we can expect to see in the next parts of the trip. And then we'll get into some juicy gossip about the meaning of what we're seeing, what it all means for us and the world more broadly. Then we'll open the floor up to the audience for some questions and answer. So this is President Trump embarking on the longest trip of a US president since George W. Bush in 1991. There's a lot of debate about the US commitment to Asia. We have had visits from various different US delegations telling us how committed the US is to Asia, and we hear a lot of stories to the contrary that the US is not committed to Asia. So we can't necessarily resolve that issue. What matters, I guess, is the perception in Asia about that commitment. So can you tell us, Huong, a little bit about the perceptions in Asia about how committed the US is there and how much it matters?
I guess there is a strong perception going on at the moment. Quite early on it is, so to be fair, just wait and see. But I guess the prevailing perception at the moment is a question mark. It's whether US is reliable or not. And I guess the first signal to make it even more questionable was his decision to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, although it didn't include every country in the region. For Southeast Asia, actually only four, right? But I guess that sent quite a strong signal that US is not necessarily as reliable and constant actor in the region, particularly because also competing initiatives going on in the region getting a lot of traction. I mean, particularly by Chinese initiatives, economic initiatives, be it AIIB or Belt and Road Initiative. So there's a lot going from one direction, but there's a little bit less from another direction, if I can put it that way. And of course, U.S. Investment and economic engagement is still there, but in realm of perception of big multilateral project of you know, strong presence, I guess there is a lot of question mark there, especially that the region is very much interested in economic development, in infrastructure, in trade and foreign investment. So in the perception realm, I think it's a little bit weak. U.S. Is performing a little bit weak at the moment. Having said that, his trip, his attendance to the APEC summit, can give some hope that he actually, you know, will have something to say at the summit. So let's wait and see for tomorrow.
Sure. But how do you think, with that perception of weakness, how do you think that makes Asian countries, Asian elites feel? Is that leave them feeling insecure and concerned about their future?
I guess it's always been a question whether, U.S. is strong or not. And I don't think any of the Southeast Asian countries like rely absolutely, even the treaty allies. So and it's not just Trump that caused that kind of uncertainty, and the Southeast Asian states have been long, struggling to strike a right balance, best for their own state interest. As in terms of psychological effect of ability to rely on a big partner like U.S. has been probably affected by Trump's rhetoric about America first and focusing on fair and reciprocal trade. So that doesn't help for sure. From, for example, Vietnam perspective, I guess they haven't given up totally, and they're still trying to talk bilaterally. The Vietnamese have gone as the first Southeast Asian leaders to go to Washington, Trump's Washington in May, and they also engage in the defense dialogue in August. So I don't think they're giving up completely.
Aaron, does that fit with what you've seen in Indonesia and other parts of Southeast Asia?
Yeah, there's clearly a desire on Southeast Asian countries' part for U.S. leadership, particularly in the economic realm, and as well in the strategic realm. And that's even more so the case for U.S. treaty allies and for Singapore and Vietnam, which have developed a really strong defense partnership with the United States under Obama and even preceding Obama. So there's clearly a desire for U.S. leadership, but while we tend to focus on Trump's tweets and on his style, which broadcasts disengagement or at least a lack of awareness or understanding of the region, the institutions in the United States are at least as important as the president himself, if not more important. And those institutions, we were fortunate, are being run by Trump nominees who are pretty conventional. We weren't sure we were going to get conventional nominees when Trump became president. You know, Rudy Giuliani was talked about as a potential Secretary of State. His views on counterterrorism run to the wrong side of the Geneva Conventions. John Bolton was talked about as potential principal. He has pretty unconventional views on the North Korean challenge. But we ended up getting pretty conventional people like Jim Mattis as Secretary of Defense and Rex Tillerson, who hold fairly conventional views on these things and look to the mainstream Republican foreign policy community for advice. And so they have been running much of the policy process. The risk is, though, that with Trump in Asia, he's interacting with East Asia policy more than he has at any time in his presidency. So while he is in Asia on this longest trip of an American president to Asia since 1991, I think we'll see Trump begin to exercise more of an influence on East Asia policy. So far, he's mostly stuck to the script. There were a few departures in Japan. But when he was speaking to the National Assembly in Korea yesterday, it was mostly he mostly stuck to the script, and that was good news. Long may that continue, because we have another 5 days of this trip. And you know, as he becomes fatigued, I worry that perhaps he'll begin to freelance a little bit, and that won't be good for Asia or for the United States.
So you and Aaron's mentioned so far, we've seen President Trump pretty much sticking to the script, with the occasional moment of personal input. Can you give us the sort of headline points of what you think we've seen so far in Japan, in Korea?
Well, they're the two major Northeast Asian allies, and this administration has taken a singular focus on North Korea, so that was the dominant theme, no deviation from that. Allies did feature in the speech that he gave in the National Assembly quite strongly. So again, that was a message of reassurance and quite a conventional line that was taken. The contrasting approach from the host side was, I thought, quite interesting in that in Japan, obviously the Japanese approach was to flatter the US president as far as possible, almost to a fault, you could say. By preparing the signed hats and laying out the kind of, right down to the choice of food, whether it was, you know, burgers, there was no sign of raw fish. But it was done on a level that I think betrayed the strategy, which is to do everything possible to personalize the relationship, to keep that hook in there. Whereas in Korea, I think it was maybe a slightly more balanced approach. The Koreans were also able to smuggle in a couple of their own priorities. President Trump was put in front of a surviving comfort woman and greeted her, which was, you know, a little smart bit of tick box diplomacy on the Korean side. But I think, as Aaron said, the speeches that he gave, he largely stuck to the script. And I think the big positive from the Korea trip is that it was very long on the importance of South Korea. It injected South Korea back into the center of the U.S. narrative in a way that has been missing. And I think the big fear has been, of course, that the U.S. is going to then engage in a military campaign without consulting its allies. And I think we're further away from that now after that speech. Also, the offer to bring North Korea to the table, I think, would have surprised a lot of people, given the very hard language in the run-up to the visit. So those are positives, I think. On the other hand, although the sort of list of priorities that was laid out in advance of this visit, you know, freedom of navigation, respect for open commerce, freedom of expression, the rest, I mean, they're all there, but they don't seem to come out in a coherent strategy. It's rather a kind of shopping list approach in which it looks conventional, but it's really, you know, how much strategy is there behind this, both in forethought and in delivery. And in trade, in the economic space, I think, which that's probably where it's still rather worrisome, because there isn't a counter-narrative to China's inducement of the One Belt, One Road. What there seems to be a sort of pell-mell grasping for a deal here, a deal there, and to put a dollar value on it, even though a lot of those dollars have been pre-committed in existing deals long in advance of the visit. So I don't think it goes as far as many in the region would like to reassure on that front. But on the military side, where I think the message is probably needs the least reinforcement, that was very strong. And the president clearly likes military motifs and military men. So visits to the base, visits to, and a scrubbed visit to the demilitarized zone where the elements conspired in the form of heavy fog to turn the helicopters back. So he didn't get his chance to look across to Kim Jong-un. But I won't fault the speech that was given. I thought it was a pretty strong speech, and it did the job of reassuring a nervous ally.
Thank you. Huang, Ewan was talking about the sort of the lack of strategy so far. What do you think about how the US is approaching Vietnam? The bilateral relationship is something that you think is very important. Do you think they're approaching that with a kind of a strategic focus or still a bit of a shopping list?
I guess from the operational level, I guess there is a strong recognition that Vietnam is quite important and growing in importance in the region. As long as Trump stick to the script, I think the relationship will continue to be on the positive trajectory. I see quite a good momentum that wasn't there before. For example, there were quite a lot of concern from the Vietnamese side on the defense, on a deepening defense collaboration. But I think there is a good political will at the moment, I believe that will continue. There is a lot of hope in that sphere to observe. And just the fact that he's making a side trip from Da Nang, where the summit is held, to Hanoi to have some bilateral meeting, there perhaps would be some interesting things to observe over there. And my only concern is perhaps a little bit of culture shock, maybe when he arrives in communist Vietnam, where I think they've held some commemoration ceremonies just a few days before, so there are a lot of red decorations everywhere. So I don't know how would that affect his feeling about Vietnam. I guess the Prime Minister Nguyễn Xuân Phúc made a fairly positive impression in May in Washington. And I know that Minister of Defense, Vietnamese Minister of Defense, also have a very positive relations with Pentagon. So, again, if he sticks to the script, I think everything should be positive.
That's a big if. So, Aaron, what about the trip to the visit to the Philippines? What should we look out for there? What should we be excited about?
Well, I think we'll see some interaction between Duterte and Trump, either in Vietnam or in the Philippines. I'm not sure where they'll do it, but it looks like it'll be in the Philippines. And that'll be interesting because a lot of people have compared Duterte and Trump. To some extent, those comparisons are a little insensitive. Trump is not responsible for the extrajudicial killing of thousands of his citizens. Duterte is. So the human rights comparison is not quite right. But they are both very earthy characters. They, you know, have a particular sort of illiberal view. They were both democratically elected. They have very illiberal views about their own countries and the opposition. And so a lot of people have speculated that they'll get along very well. But the leaders who get along best with Trump are leaders like Abe, who are solicitous and are willing to sort of allow their egos to be subsumed under Trump's ego. And Duterte is not one of those leaders. So it could be, it could actually be very uncomfortable for both of them. Of course, last year at the East Asia Summit, Duterte, had said to the Filipino press, the Philippines press prior to the meeting, that if Obama raised human rights, he would call him a bad name. The Lowy Institute podcast is a family, podcast. So I don't want to repeat. We hope. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so, but, you know, if Duterte does something like that again with Trump, I'm not sure that Trump will handle it as coolly as Obama did. Obama really kind of let it roll off his shoulders. And so I don't know that, it'll go down as well as, some have forecasted. The other big thing in the Philippines is the East Asia Summit. And of course, Trump said originally that he wasn't going to go to the East Asia Summit, and that was seen as a really serious sign of a lack of American commitment under Donald Trump. He was going to leave a day earlier. And since 2011, when the U.S. joined the East Asia Summit, it has really come to be seen as the litmus test for U.S. engagement, diplomatic engagement in Asia. Whether or not that's the right litmus test or not, I think is up for debate, but there was no question it was going to have an effect. And so Trump is going to stay for the East Asia Summit now. Analysts and journalists bullied the White House into committing to staying for the East Asia Summit because they convinced the White House that it would really be costly for them. So I think that's a positive thing. But, you know, again, the question is, will Trump stick to the script? Last year, the East Asia Summit plenary was 4.5 hours long. And that was after the Lao chair tried to shorten it. I don't know how long it'll go this year. But if Trump is forced to sit through a 4-hour long meeting and sort of listen to all these 17 other heads of state hold forth on things like sustainable development, I don't know that he'll react very well if somebody like Cambodia's Hun Sen brings up the U.S. war debt to Cambodia, which he's been harping on recently. And so I'm concerned as to how Trump will react in that context.
What do you think could happen? What could go wrong?
Well, so, you know, last year, Duterte and the East Asia Summit brought up U.S. human rights abuses on Jolo in 1906, and he showed photos of the Bud Dajo massacre. And so, you know, if Hun Sen brings up, for instance, unexploded ordnance in Cambodia, and, you know, attacks Trump personally, That's not the sort of thing that Trump has handled very well in the past. And he could lash out. And that won't go over very well with many of the other ASEAN countries in the room who would prefer more equanimity from one of the great powers, the leader of one of the great powers in the room. Mm.
So speaking about ASEAN and these multilateral summits, Obama was very pro-multilateralism, and Trump is clearly more skeptical about it. Does this represent a big turnaround, Ewan? Do you think from Obama's approach, how will this matter to the region?
I think Obama was already the high water mark of U.S. Multilateralism, and particularly with ASEAN, it would be very difficult even for a Clinton administration to have matched the level of commitment that was there. So I think we were probably all over the other side of the slope. But there's a obvious shift to a much more old-fashioned style of bilateralism, alliances first, but also the wheeler-dealing side, the new partners, I think it plays to the great power, maximize your negotiation leverage, which again is a kind of mirror imaging of China's behavior in that sense in the region. That's an obvious shift, but it's one to which Southeast Asian leaders have accommodated themselves surprisingly niftily. We've seen the visit of the Vietnamese Prime Minister, Singapore Prime Minister Najib from Malaysia. That's quite surprising. This early stage of a presidency to be able to get that many bilateral visits to the White House. So it shows you that I think the multilateral machinery of ASEAN is its currency is in any case being devalued, not just in the US eyes, but China has, I think, done a good job of putting a wrecking ball in there with the South China Sea. But to bring things to a local focus, we have Malcolm Turnbull going up there just today, and there will be probably a working level four-way meeting between the so-called Quad parties, Australia, Japan, the United States, and India, at the working level, senior officials, so it won't be the leaders themselves. But that is an implicit message about the importance of ASEAN, because it bypasses ASEAN as an organization, but also none of the members are part of that four. So it shows you that there is a kind of, if you like, a creeping concert approach Japan has made the running in that initiative. Australia has agreed to run with it. So I think the United States is not totally at odds with other the other great powers and middle powers' approach to this.
So one country that's put a lot of emphasis on ASEAN is Vietnam, and has been trying to take a leadership role with ASEAN, particularly in issues around the South China Sea. Does this kind of devaluing of the currency of ASEAN affect Vietnam and affect what they're trying to do in the region?
I guess it's quite complex at the moment, especially that the chairmanship of this 50th anniversary of ASEAN happens to be Philippines, who allegedly have the highest stake in the South China Sea dispute. So Vietnam has been quite disappointed, I would say, in terms of how weak this year around the performance of ASEAN Summit has been, especially in regards to regional conflict, regional disputes debate. But I guess, yes, it would help ASEAN to be a little bit more be active in the regional diplomacy. And Vietnam is one of the one that really wants, for example, the discussed code of conduct to be legally binding. So far, we have only a vague framework of it and internal dispute, internal disagreement within ASEAN countries whether or not it should be legally binding. So for Vietnam, I guess the lack of this regional support, strong regional diplomacy channel is quite also disappointing, but again, ASEAN still has its value. Next year is Singapore as the chair. So, don't give up hope, I would say. But again, I do get the sense that, South China Sea, we've reached a moment where almost it's like a South China Sea fatigue. The one that didn't get fatigue is Vietnam, that is still trying to bring up the agenda of South China Sea, in the multilateral setting. And efforts must be there, even though there must be someone still driving the debate and conversation, and not to give up too early.
So if the multilateral forum is not going to be the place necessarily anymore that Vietnam can pursue its goals for the South China Sea, does that have implications then for Vietnam's bilateral relationship with the US as a means to try and achieve those ends?
It's one off for sure. I mean, Vietnam has been very active and in improving relationship not only with the US but also other partners, including Australia, India, Japan, and other partners. So I guess Vietnam has put many eggs in many baskets so far, and so has other countries, so as other ASEAN countries. So unfortunately, perhaps the second 50 years of ASEAN, we might have to rethink a little bit the role of ASEAN and its role in the region, because South China Sea, if you want to put it as the litmus test for ASEAN, it's not performing too well.
Aaron, what do you think? Do you think that this means that the US-Vietnam relationship will change in its tone, and there'll be more pressure on the US from Vietnam to step up its support of the Vietnamese cause in the South China Sea?
What's really interesting, and this is coming through pretty clearly on this trip, is there are two US administrations at the moment. You have Donald Trump himself, who is a skeptic of alliances, does not really care about these big sort of regional security issues and regional stability and security as a public good. And is a skeptic of free trade agreements, one of which would have been negotiated, the TPP, partly with Vietnam. And then you have the rest of the administration, which again have these very conventional views on foreign policy, and they do care about what they have phrased as the free and open Indo-Pacific and ensuring that China can't coerce its neighbors into positions into compromising their sovereignty on these issues. And so you have Donald Trump, who has sort of, in name at least, committed to this free and open Indo-Pacific idea, and advisors who don't. So question is, which one of those went out over time? And I think while Trump is in Asia, you'll see a much more transactional diplomacy. It'll be very interesting how he handles going from China, where he's said very nice things about Xi Jinping, to going to Vietnam, where he's going to want to say unpleasant things about Xi Jinping, or his advisors will be pushing him to do that, and how he handles those contradictions. But when he leaves Asia, I think you'll begin to see the system take back over, and in what in my paper I've called the autopilot. And that is a trajectory that both Republicans and Democrats have set on Asia policy for a number of administrations. And while the autopilot was last programmed in the Obama administration, and maybe not perfectly, there were certainly some improvements and adjustments that could have been made. I think that's the dominant trajectory that we've seen in Asian policy under Trump so far. So, regardless of what we see on this trip, I actually think that there's more stability in U.S. East Asia policy than we've given the Trump administration credit for so far.
Would you agree? Would you say that the administration is calmly getting on with business as usual with U.S. policy towards Asia?
No, I don't think it is business as usual. I don't think we'll ever go back to business as usual. The Obama administration at least tried to have a semblance of a strategy, but in its execution, I'd probably give it a B or B minus. And I waved a flag for the rebalance because I believed it was the right thing to do. But I think it failed well short of its objectives, partly because there's always a tension for the US, which is, as a global power, pulled to the Middle East and other places like Russia. But I think there's maybe a more important power shift. This is where I think Hugh White's got it right, is that there is, I think, probably a readjustment that's coming. That there isn't a point at which you can endlessly tweak an administration's policy and somehow always manage to remain in the kind of framework of post-1945 primacy. Now, I'm not writing off the US. The US is still a powerful and important actor in all spheres of power. But it's a long way away. And that geographical removal also counts against it. It means it has to be really revving on all cylinders to be able to compete with China at that level. China's not going to get any less powerful anytime soon. So I think it's very difficult for any U.S. administration to grasp that. But there probably is an adjustment that was coming. And I think that adjustment is being accelerated by the Trump administration, despite its best efforts. And as Aaron describes it, the conventional people in the administration. But give you one example, in sheer operational terms. I said the military leg of the U.S. presence is the strongest, but we've had two recent collisions of U.S. destroyers. That actually was a very good physical example of trying to do more with less. And if you always try to do more with less, then you end up with less in the end. They were run ragged. Their operational tempo required to sort of match the presence that has been expected of them, partly in response to the crowding out of Chinese presence in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, were led into making basic navigational errors that resulted in major loss of life and damage to both ships. Now, that's just a microcosm, but to me, that actually speaks in the physical world, not the world of perceptions, that there is already a kind of basis of evidence that it's not business as usual any longer.
Huang, I just want to go back to Vietnam a little bit. So you mentioned earlier that if Trump sticks to the script, things will be okay. And we've talked a little bit in your papers about, you know, the real importance of that bilateral relationship between the US and Vietnam. If Trump doesn't stick to the script, what will happen? How will Vietnam react to a Trump that goes a little bit haywire?
Well, their relationship has been long-term, very complex, and there are many challenges to the relationship. And I guess with Trump in the office, there are new challenges, and this new challenge is particularly the issue of trade. Again, Vietnam has a trade surplus with U.S. Last year was ranked at $32 billion or something, sixth, I think, on the list of 16 countries that U.S. has a trade deficit with. And if Trump see it as more important than the long-term partnership with Vietnam, then this can be quite a difficult situation for Vietnam, because it is economy that will really decide whether Vietnam can afford to have really strong and independent foreign policy. So Vietnam is trying to expand its FTA network, trying to talk, have some idea how otherwise can replace the unfortunate the TPP. Although, as I said, the TPP-11 negotiations are happening on the side of APEC summit as well. So there is also a hope to show the strategic importance of Vietnam to Trump. And I guess one kind of advantage of Vietnam is ability of flexible arrangements, and like treaty allies, Vietnam can be quite a flexible partner. And unlike some regional partners, the trajectory with Vietnam is positive. Whereas partners and allies in Southeast Asia have had better times with the U.S. So it's always kind of more optimistic when improving and deepening relations, and you see the signs of cooperation and political will. So, the leaders of Vietnam are quite hopeful, I would say.
I'd like to open up the floor to questions from our audience. If you have a question, could you please wait until the mic comes around and then just give us your name and your affiliation, please? We welcome questions from all comers on any topic.
Barclay Cox is my name, King and Wood Mallesons. Given the relative weight of the economic imperative of Australia's engagement with China, comparing it to the security imperative that sort of sits around this discussion. Could you give us a perspective on what Australia can and should do as a facilitator in this environment?
It looks like that was directed at you.
I think the glass half full of all the vexation and uncertainty around the US commitment is that finally it should shake Australia out of its complacency. And when I say complacency, there is a complacent mindset view that the alliance is there and it's a bedrock and then it never shifts. I think now really is the test for Australia and its partners to take up the slack, to provide the ballast, because they have another choice, which isn't to rally to China as the next big thing and the next big economic opportunity. There are many other significant countries in the region, Japan, India, all of Southeast Asia. Now, in the economic space, I know that's harder than it sounds. Doing trade with Indonesia is very difficult. India is in the same space. China is a long leap ahead. But I think it's in that broader economic as well as the diplomatic space where there needs to be an attempt to thicken up those ties between the alliances, the American allies and partners. That's why I think that the Quad talks, although it's just the beginning of a process and it's a working level meeting, is symbolic, more than just symbolically significant. There has to be a broader diversification in the economic realm to avoid a reliance on China as a market. There again, I think Australia has been complacent with the commodities-led boom, which was very easy to do. We're moving into a much more difficult economic ground to negotiate with China as we move up the value chain. But I think there has to be a kind of broader strategic emphasis to maximize those partnerships, to bring them closer together for all they're worth, so that it's not just a binary choice of the emerging rising China and the relative decline of the United States. It's a bigger region than that.
Oh, yes, Aaron.
Yeah, I just think it depends on how you define the challenge. If you define the challenge the way that Hugh White does, which is it is Australia's role to convince the United States that it needs to resign itself to a second place role in Asia, to a lesser role in Asia, to sort of cede the Western Pacific to China, then I don't think that there is a role for Australia. That's not something that the United States is likely to agree to. And I don't think that the Australian entreaties to do something like that are likely to be effective. But if you define Australia's role in a more nuanced way, in doing some of the things that UN has talked about, but then also Australia's been very effective during the Trump administration. The reason that all these Southeast Asian leaders were going to Washington this year was not because they saw in the Trump administration a great opportunity for partnership. It's because they knew they needed to get in there to convince the Trump administration of certain facts on the ground before China did. And so Vietnam was the first in. Southeast Asian countries were very concerned, for instance, about the relationship between Jared Kushner and Sui Chiang Kai, China's ambassador in Washington. And that was basically a direct line to President Trump that China was using to convince him that China's vision of the region was one that the United States should accept and should welcome. And so Southeast Asian countries went to Washington to convince them otherwise. And Julie Bishop and people from DFAT went to Washington to convince the Trump administration otherwise. And they've been pretty effective. And to give you just a specific example, when the Trump administration announced that it was not going to go to the East Asia Summit, which had been something that Australia had been trying to convince them to do for much of the year, it was foreign leaders, and the U.S. hasn't said which specific foreign leaders, but Australia is clearly in the game here. It was foreign leaders who convinced President Trump to go to the East Asia Summit, that it was important to demonstrate that commitment. It's also Australia that's taking a leadership role in renegotiating the TPP to allow it to be an agreement that the United States might be able to rejoin in 2021. So I think there are very clearly things that Australia can do to keep the United States engaged in Asia during the Trump administration. And this government has actually done those pretty effectively. That's where I think the Australian role comes in. But Hugh hopes the United States is going to sort of retreat from Asia and that Australia can play a role in convincing them to do that, I don't think that's likely to come to pass.
Thanks. Brian Everingham, Institute of International Affairs. To what extent, and this is to all of you in the panel, but to what extent has the hollowing out of the State Department affected the way the Americans are doing business in Asia at the moment? And has Trump therefore become more reliant on, let's call it, a kitchen cabinet?
Obviously, it doesn't help. We still have an acting secretary for East Asian Affairs, so there's no appointee, and we're more than a year now from the election. And the morale issue, I think, is clearly felt in how State Department writ large is able to steer the juggernaut of U.S. diplomacy. I think in Asia, there's a bit of ballast in the form of not just the Pentagon, but specifically the Pacific Command. Pacific Command has a very strong historical sway over policy in the Pacific on the military leg. And that, I think, has helped provide some needed continuity in the form of Admiral Harry Harris, who may be the next U.S. Ambassador here in Australia. But I think the human element is always key when it comes to getting decisions made, and we've even seen that in the security realm where PACOM ought to be able to push through a supportive policy on freedom of navigation operations quicker than it did. But that took a long time to progress up the decision tree, and we saw actually countervailing influences on that, rather similar to the Obama administration, strangely. But where the China relationship comes into play, there are always these other tensions with economic priorities and other global level goals, although climate change is clearly not one that holds much importance for the current administration. We don't have an ambassador in Seoul, don't have a US ambassador here. Doesn't mean that the ship can't be steered at a lower level. Sometimes there are advantages to not having an ambassador there. But I think in Seoul in particular, that's why I place so much emphasis on the speech that Trump gave, because it was a very needed message of reassurance, and part of the reassurance was just the vacuum of diplomatic engagement.
I think the State Department has not been hollowed out as much as perhaps it's been represented in the press. Certainly there's been a lot of turnover, and more turnover than there would normally be from administration to administration. And it would be great if we had an ambassador here, although the chargé d'affaires is doing a great job, and I think arguably a more capable job than many of the political appointee ambassadors that Australia has suffered under in years past. So there are actually advantages to having acting people in these roles from time to time. But they don't really speak with the authority of the Trump administration, or at least sometimes are perceived not to. So it would be good to have people in those roles, particularly in Seoul, which is sort of shocking that we don't yet have an ambassador in Seoul 11 months into the administration, 10 months in. But I don't actually see it as a huge crisis. I think Ewan's right that there's a lot of ballast. That Pacific Command in Honolulu, which one Australian official once told me acts as an independent government, that they actually have a lot of influence over U.S. East Asia policy. And Harry Harris has been in place because that's not a position that changes with administrations. And whoever is likely to replace him is likely to have very similar views as Admiral Harris. So I don't think it's been the crisis that has been represented. What I'm more concerned about is the long-term health of the Foreign Service and the State Department. We saw a 50% decline in applications to the Foreign Service this year, from 17,000 to somewhere south of 10,000. That's pretty shocking. That's not good. And I know a lot of Foreign Service officers who are questioning whether or not they want to continue to serve under this administration, and that these are nonpartisan civil servants who would never have done that under any other Republican. But this administration is different. And so I worry about the long-term health of the State Department, but I actually think most of them believe that they are holding the line against an America First policy that's coming down from the White House, and that it's important for them to remain in place at their battle stations in order to sort of fight back against more base instincts in American politics right now.
It also looks it's particularly difficult for the State Department given the clearly marginalized position of Rex Tillerson.
Thanks. There was a question from the gentleman up the back.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask a question. I'm Jeffrey White, private citizen. Is there a chance that Trump will come away from this this trip with his mind opened up considerably to the wonders of Asia and the wonderful people and culture they have. And this will change his whole approach to Asia.
He certainly learned a lot about the complexities of North Korea last time he went, so there is some possibility. Huang, any thoughts?
Oh, that's certainly a hope, but completely that's a quite an ambitious goal, even for, you know, the many wonders of Asia, given that he voluntarily passed on the cuisine of Asian cuisine, for example. So that won't win his heart. But I do think that this trip can have some positive input into his perception of Asia, that there's a lot of complex issues. There's not only one complex issue. So perhaps, you know, it will stimulate some interest of his own once he has that, you know, private connection. I always joke that, for example, Vietnam is a very dynamic market. So perhaps, you know, a Trump Tower would do well for his business. But joke aside, no, it's really, I think it's a very dynamic region, and hopefully he will see the importance of American role in this dynamic region.
I think the visit to Japan is an interesting test of that, because clearly Trump had an issue with Japan going back to the 1980s. So he can change his mind on that score. It was clear he was also still thinking in the 1980s mindset when he talked about Japan winning economically. Well, if you look at the figures for the last 20 years, it's hard to make that case now. So that sort of old think is hardwired in him. But it's not to say that there isn't ways to work around it. They often say that the person who has the last conversation with the president is the one who has the most influence, so maybe it'll work to the Philippines' favor in that sense, or maybe he'll be so cranky at the end of the trip that it won't. But I think those the visit to Seoul and the visit to Japan are key. The other one, of course, is China, and I hope he doesn't have too positive an impression as a result of his visit there, because that's another corresponding risk, is that if he sees this purely in terms of a great-power-to-great-power relationship and these sort of laudatory comments that he's consistently made of President Xi, going over the heads of the other countries and doing the Uber deal, I think that's the fear on the part of the other Asian countries. But I think his advisors will be doing everything they can to corral him away from that.
Thanks, Yan Jie from the Law Institute. So I got a question for Dr. Huang. And so I wonder whether you could comment on how Vietnam balanced its relationship with China and the U.S. The reason why I ask this question, because after Trump visited Vietnam, President Xi Jinping will also have the state visit to Vietnam. So what do you think leaders in Vietnam will talk to Trump and talk to Xi respectively? Thanks.
Well, this is the question that the leaders in Vietnam think of about every day. And it's a very hard question to respond to. Just a few days before Trump's visit, actually, Wang Yi also visited Hanoi. And there are some signs to, improve the relationship. And it is neighborly relationship. So it is very important for Vietnam to keep it as proper as possible. And with the U.S., as I said, Vietnam is actively trying to engage U.S. not only bilaterally, but also welcome U.S. Presence in the region. So like any small and middle-sized state in the region, I think the balance is critical, particularly for Vietnam. Vietnam has always adopted this very nuanced strategy of struggling and cooperating at the same time. So, striking a right balance and depending really on the issue on time. It's more of a cooperating or more of struggle. And for Vietnam, it is also important to be independent. It doesn't want to be over relying on any of the partner, so it makes makes the whole struggle even harder. But I don't know if that answers your question.
There was a question from the lady down in the front row, please.
Thanks. Michelle Conrad, NAUS Group. We've heard a lot recently about what various actors in the Trump administration think ought to be done about North Korea. I wonder if you have any insight on what the Asian countries in the region think ought to be done about North Korea.
I mean, I think the singular focus of the U.S. is, or has made North Korea felt in for many Asian countries in a way that it hasn't been previously. I was at the Shangri-La Dialogue in June, and it was pretty clear there that behind the scenes, a lot of the U.S. effort was around trying to increase economic and diplomatic pressure on the ASEAN countries to reduce their ties with North Korea. Again, they've had some effect on that. I mean, I think although the policy has been sometimes all over the place and inconsistent in its messaging, the urgency alone which the U.S. has brought under this administration has, I think, had an effect. And we've seen that in the form of sanctions, which, although it was commonplace to think that North Korea was the most heavily sanctioned country, in actual fact, we saw how much wiggle room they had to go under the radar and evade those sanctions. Now I think they're feeling more pressure in a way that they have for a long time. But that's, for Southeast Asia, I think it's still basically it's a reflection of something that the US is asking us to do and what can we get out of it in return. I think for Japan and for South Korea, for obvious reasons, they're in the firing line. They feel it directly. They also live with a current nuclear threat. That's, I think, the important difference. If we're looking at sometimes these formulations out of the US that we can't live with a nuclear North Korea, well, Japan and South Korea have been for the best part of 10 years, maybe longer. They've learned to live with that. So maybe there's, for them, there's a... they would prefer some of them to have, for the US to have a similar patience if the alternative is a costly conflict which has uncertain prospects of escalation and could be bloody long and protracted and ruin the global economy. Well, those are big stakes to play for, and I think South Korea will be reassured that the US did make an offer of talks and bringing back North Korea to the table, not only talking in terms of punishment on this visit. China is of course seen as often as the key holder on North Korea because it holds the economic levers that no other country does, and it has the political relationship still that no other country does with North Korea. There, I think the US is always on a perpetual administration cycle that by the time it gets to the end of the 4 years, whoever's the incumbent president realizes that China isn't going to deliver that that magic bolt solution. President Trump's somewhere at the lower end of that circle right now, I think.
I would just mention in terms of ASEAN countries, it was really interesting to see Southeast Asian countries' reactions to the killing of Kim Jong-nam in KL's international airport earlier this year. This was a biological weapon attack in the middle of a pretty sophisticated international airport in the capital of an ASEAN country. And I think it really woke ASEAN countries up to the danger that they were courting by continuing to host North Korean embassies and businesses. And so, you know, for instance, we just learned today, it's not quite in Southeast Asia, but there was $150,000 worth of liquor stolen from the North Korean embassy in Islamabad. And it turns out the North Koreans were basically literally smuggling rum into Pakistan. But this is the sort of thing that they were doing all over the world. And so actually under the Obama administration, the State Department in 2015 started to pressure countries to close North Korean embassies, to even terminate diplomatic relations with North Korea, and to close these North Korean restaurants that have proliferated all over the region. The Jakarta Post, if you have time when you get home, wrote a great restaurant review of the North Korean restaurant in North Jakarta, which was not much of a restaurant. It was a front for something else. And probably, although this was never confirmed, for pretty significant methamphetamine imports into Indonesia. And so Southeast Asian countries had an interest in closing some of these establishments. What they weren't willing to do, and which the U.S. had asked them to do under the Trump administration, was kick North Korea out of something called the ASEAN Regional Forum, which was actually an Australian creation dating back to the 80s. And so The U.S. demanded that North Korea be kicked out, or strongly urged Southeast Asian countries to kick them out. Southeast Asia basically said, this is the only regional forum that North Korea is a part of. If there's going to be some door open to diplomacy, then it should be through the ASEAN Regional Forum, so we're not going to kick them out of that. So there was a limit to how far they were willing to go, and Malaysia, for instance, still has not closed its North Korean embassy, but there has been some action on their part because of the killing of Kim Jong-nam, not so much because of the nuclear threat.
Did you want to talk about that from the Vietnamese perspective?
Yeah, similar plot, because actually in the killing, there was a Vietnamese national involved, so the Vietnamese government was quite angry about the whole thing. But other than diplomatic statements that the Vietnamese Ministry of Foreign Affairs have given, and also there are decreased volumes of trade, I guess, in practical sense. I think Vietnam would be also opposing to close the diplomatic doors to North Korea, and I think they think it is important to actually have access to and engage in a negotiation. And similarly, I think Singaporeans see the value of engaging North Korean. And I know that there are some informal meetings aside happening actually in Singapore. So I think the value of talk, again, traditionally in Southeast Asian way, in ASEAN way, is still supported.
Wong reminds me that if you look at embassies at countries that have downgraded their diplomatic relationships, they're all outside Asia. It's Peru, Bulgaria, Spain, Italy, but no country in Asia that I'm aware of has actually downgraded its diplomatic relationships. So I think that's absolutely right. There isn't really a tradition. Even Malaysia, which was on the receiving end of that assassination bid, and had its diplomatic staff as effectively held hostage for several weeks in Pyongyang, but they haven't cut their ties.
And for China, which, you know, people arguably argue that it, you know, really holds the key, you know, their interests, as Ewan alluded to, their interests are so different from the US's, and their desire to keep America represented in South Korea away from their doorstep is so profound and deep that they would rather keep the sort of status quo as it is and push, and that's why you get this cycle of, oh yes we will, oh yes we will, we'll do a bit here, we'll do a bit there, but they're profoundly uninterested in achieving the same goals as the US wants to achieve, so they won't be pushing harder anytime soon. There won't be a big change of policy there. Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of our time. We've had, I think, a really wide-ranging discussion, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have and learned as much as I have. Please join me in thanking our panelists, Ewan, Fong, and Aaron. And thank you again for coming along this evening.